Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 4, delivered on January 21, 2016. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve.
Today, the Federal Reserve. Now, I'm going to post a, the video is actually show already in your resources on ReggieNet, and I'm going to post it on my own podcasting site, isu-prof.com. I might even email you the link. There's a video that the Federal Reserve of St. Louis puts out that's like an animated video. It sort of covers in a light way what I'm doing here in for you in the classroom. I get into more detail than the one in that video, but it's a good overview. So if you don't get everything here, you'll catch some of it there on that site. But to begin this session, I'm going to show you just a little bit of math. You're going to do your first pricing of a debt instrument, the price of it. And underneath this, though, I'm not really so interested in you being able to calculate the price. Well, I am interested in that. But I'm more interested in you seeing a fundamental principle of finance, one that I haven't shown you yet. I've hinted at it a couple of times, but I haven't shown it to you yet. And so this will be the first opportunity you have to see one of our basic. Remember that one that I told you the last time, a couple of lectures ago, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. That's a huge one. This is another one of those fundamental underlying principles of finance that drives a lot of the stuff that we'll do later. And it's important to the discussion of the Federal Reserve. But without further ado, if I could wake this document camera up and see if I can make it actually show. There. Okay. Now, the way, and I'm going to use the platform of a Treasury auction. The United States government in the current era runs big federal budget deficits. And they have to finance those deficits by borrowing money. Now remember that I told you in a previous lecture that in finance, in business in general, we don't talk about borrowing. We use the term selling. We sell a security. I sell a security, a debt security to you. You buy it for a specific price. That means I am going to borrow money, and the price you pay for the security that I'm selling is how much you're lending me, okay? So the Treasury Department of the United States government finances its operations that aren't covered by taxes and other revenues. It finances those by borrowing money. It holds auctions for Treasury securities, various kinds. If for short term, it'll sell Treasury bills, those 1 year or less securities. For intermediate term projects, it will sell Treasury notes. And for long term projects, it will sell Treasury bonds. Now, the one that I'm going to focus on here is a special, the special one, the Treasury bill, a 1 year Treasury. It is what is called a discount debt security. The reason it's called that is because, essentially, the government pays you back $1,000 in 1 year. You buy the security for something less than $1,000. The difference between what you buy it at the Treasury auction, and the $1,000 you get back is your interest. Now, most debt securities don't work that way in corporate and government. Essentially, most debt securities, you sell them for about $1,000 each, and then over the life of the security, you get your interest payments, and then at the end, you get your $1,000 back. But a treasury bill is special. It's a discount instrument. All you get at the end is the difference between what you bought it for and the $1,000. So you'll probably want to have your calculator. If you've got a calculator handy, it's just a basic calculator is all you'll need to do this. But it is important, and I do ask a question on the quiz about this, that special topics quiz. So make sure that you can do it. If I can find my own calculator here. Oh, good. There we go. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a treasury auction. Now, back in the day, literally, the government would have on the table different debt securities. And the investors, lenders, rich people, trusts, foreign governments would come to the auction and they would buy these treasury securities of different kinds. And there was essentially an auction process. Well, I'll pay this for it. No, I'll pay more for it. I'll pay less for it. And the government would raise money. If it didn't raise enough, it would just print more and get them on the table. The government will get the money that it needs, regardless of how much it costs to the cost of borrowing. Well, let's make a simple auction. Back in the day, now it's all electronic and all that, but going back to the old days, what we're going to do is we're going to have an auction, a treasury auction that will be purely treasury bills, T-bills, the one-year discount debt security. Now remember, when you buy a T-bill, you get $1,000 back in 1 year. Now, there are people milling around here at the auction, and you, sir, you come wandering in. This is the first time you've ever gone to one of these auctions, and I am the hostess. My name is Mabel. I am Treasury Department Hostess Mabel. Well, hi there, young man. Well, this is your first auction. How nice. My God, you're a strapping young beefcake cougar bait if ever I saw it. Yes, indeed. Here. Yeah, come here. You want a treasury bill? Well, we got a really nice one right here. It's printed in, it's got a peach border on it. And remember, in 1 year, you'll get $1,000 for this. Now, there are other people here, and they want it, too. That gentleman right there, he was going to offer $960 for it. So if you want it, you're going to have to offer me a little more, but I'll give you a special. You offer me a little more, and I'll take care of you, because I'm sure you'll take care of me later, won't you? My God, you're gorgeous. Anyway, so what do you say? What do you want to buy this treasury bill for? No, he's bidding 970, thick burger. 975. Well, that sounds reasonable. Earl, bag a 975 T-bill, drag it through the garden. So I roll up. There you go, young man. Now remember, in 1 year, you'll get $1,000 back, and here's my number, too. Please call me. My God, yes, call me. I'm lonely at night. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Watch. Now, there is the price value of the security. And then we're going to talk about the face value. The face value is what you're going to pay for that what you're going to get back. The face, as we call it. Now, and you remember this for the rest of your lives, unless I say differently, face is always $1,000. Face is always $1,000. It doesn't matter if I am teaching you in your MBA, your PhD, if I am teaching you from my grave, face is $1,000 unless I say differently. Do not come up to me on a test and say, well, you didn't tell me the face value because I will eat your butt. Okay? Gourmet dining is out the window these days. Okay. Now, the first thing is, this gentleman has offered me $975 for this security. In one year, what is he going to get back? Oh, thank God, I didn't want to eat your butt. $1,000. Okay, so now, In other words, tell me, how much interest in dollars did he earn over that year? He bought it for $975. He got $1,000. So how many dollars of interest did he get?
We could figure it out.
No, just tell me right off the top of your head. It is right there. He paid $975. He got $1,000. So how many dollars did he get in interest? Good. You were trying to think of something really complicated. I almost heard gears working in there. No, that's all there is to it. That really is all there is to it. He got $25 in interest. So now we can calculate the yield. Now the 1 year is great because it is exactly a 1 year, and we always like to have everything in 1 year for interest rates. So that's why this one's a really sweet one to use. Okay, so the way I would do it is, how much did he get in interest? What did you say?
25.
How much did he pay? How much did he invest? Talk to me. How much did he invest? Bingo. Don't ever put $1,000 in the denominator. That's the thing that I see people do, and I even try to catch people. I'll put it the answer if you put $1,000. No, he invested $975. So now we can figure out what the yield on this little bad boy is that he got. $25 divided by $975. He got 2.56% interest. That was the yield on the instrument. A 1 year yield. 2.56%. That's all there is to finding the yield on it. Now, when it gets more complicated, trust me, it can get fiendishly complicated with a really long formula. I'm going to show you how to do it on a calculator because there are only a few who are doing it by hand with the formulas anymore. In some cases, you can't. It's really hard to do it with the formulas. So the calculators, when it gets more complicated, when you got coupons in there and all of that kind of stuff, it's don't worry about it. But okay, now we are now at the end. You did it. Now you're feeling butch. You have invested in government securities. So a year later, you come back to the auction. Well, there you are again. Wasn't that it? My goodness, I knew you couldn't stay away. Listen, you're here back here for the auction. Oh, how nice. Yes. Now you're looking around. You notice that the room is quite empty today. There aren't investors wandering around. It's pretty slow around here. Well, young man, we got some new treasury bills, and it's time for you to invest again. Well, we got a nice one-year treasury bill right here. Well, we've got them in pale blue border this time, and that really goes with those eyes of yours. God, those eyes. Yes, indeed. Okay, son, what do you want to bid for this treasury bill? Are you out of your freaking mind? Listen, Sonny. I've been around the trailer park more times than that. $975 when there was stiff demand. Don't push it here, hot dog. Come down a little bit.
$50.
No! For God's sake, $950. $50, my goodness, what do you think I am? Good God. Brain power of a Trump supporter. I shouldn't have said that. $950. You see, you can bid less because there's not as much competition. The demand is not as stiff. That's one thing, is that if the demand is slack in an auction, the prices of the treasuries will go down. People, the bidding just won't be ferocious enough. So at $950, you can catch the government lower and ask $950 for this one. Earl, bag one for the young man. $950 on this one. Notice that the price is lower. Okay, so now, sir, talk to me. What's the face value of this a debt instrument? Oh, I love it when you talk dirty like that. Yes. My goodness.
Mabel is feeling very frisky tonight.
Okay. Now work it, girl. How much interest, dollar interest? How much?
$50.
You guys are actually pretty darn good at this. Sometimes it's like pulling teeth doing this little trick some semesters. Okay, so this time, for an investment of $950, he got $50 in interest. So now we can do a yield on this one this time. $50 over $950. And we'll crank that one out and see what our yield is. 50 divided by 950, 5.26% interest. The principle is sitting there. One of the most fundamental principles in all of finance. When the price of any security goes down, all other things being equal, when the price of any security goes down, talk to me. What happens to the yield? Can you tell me what happens to the yield? When the price goes down, the yield goes. You need to go to a tattoo parlor and get that tattooed on your ass. That is a tat that will make you butch. Okay? Price and yield are inversely related. The higher the price, the lower the yield. The lower the price, the higher the yield. It is a fundamental principle. Prices going down mean yields are going up, expected returns. That's why when the stock market starts its tailspin like it has in the last week or two, what you're seeing is essentially expected returns going up. And expected return, the greater the expected return, the greater the risk. So when those stock prices are going down, that means implicitly that expected returns are going up. The expected returns are going up because the markets are seeing more risk in the market. So what we are looking at in a down hurricane of the stock market is investors' assessment that the risks of investments are going up. And risks go up because of macroeconomic conditions, government policy, whatever. But you can always, always rely on this rule that if you see prices of things going down, that means that there is probably an expectation of greater risk involved in that. Because if prices are going down, expected yields are going up, which means that fundamentally the risk assessment is rising. Yes. Oh, God, there were some times when... I mean, remember I told you about that time in the late 1970s when there was the money supply was being clamped down so hard? You saw prices on bonds, I mean, even decent bonds in the $800 range. Now, if you're going with junk bonds... Sometimes you can get junk bonds. I mean, there are some junk bonds that are ridiculously low priced. You're supposed to get $1,000 back in 30 years, and the investors are just sitting back, nope, maybe $400, $500 for one of those. Because, I mean, the risk of them is so high. And, I mean, that's one of the problems, though, is that with amateur investors, they see a bargain on a price. On a debt instrument or a stock. Well, I found the Kmart Blue Light Specials here. Well, they don't really understand that what they're doing is they are bearing much greater risk because of that. And that's a good point, too, is that when we look at prices of bonds, essentially, we are implicitly looking at the yields on those bonds. And so if you're looking at these, say, grade C bonds, you're going to see prices that are actually pretty surprisingly low on those $700, $800 bonds. I mean, I don't want to say, well, last semester I was showing the students a couple of companies that have retail giants that have been in serious trouble over the last few years, Sears and JCPenney. Their debt instruments, the prices of those were actually in the like $700, $800 range on those bonds simply because the companies, there's such risk in investing in their bonds. Are they going to pay off? The default premium is just ridiculous on those things. But yeah. So you see, here's the backdrop. The Federal Reserve is our central bank. Now we, almost every reputable country on earth has a Federal Reserve. The reason being that the central bank is essentially like a node, a place where everything in banking can be brought together. Before there was a central bank in the United States, the central bank, U.S. central bank, is called the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is overseen by seven governors, the Board of Governors. They are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. One of them is the chairman. There aren't seven governors and a chairman. One of the seven is the chairman. Now, the federal, back when this all started, back in the 1800s, after the Civil War, it was like a Wild West. The finance scene, banking, it was just ridiculous. It was just like there were these predators setting up sod banks and failing massively, and then there were these real Wall Street geniuses who were doing all kind, one scam after another, and banks were collapsing. You see, if banks don't keep all of the money you deposit, they keep a part of it. So, and then they invest the rest, lend people money, lend businesses money, invest in projects. So, if a bank doesn't keep enough money in its vault to satisfy demand for deposits, the bank will just collapse right there and then. Some banks essentially collapsed just because they were bad banks and they just didn't keep enough money for people who came in to get some of their money out of the bank. That problem, though, with that is that sometimes what would happen is that one bank that was scurrilous would collapse because it just wasn't doing, it couldn't pay, take care of its depositors. But then that would freak people out about other banks, and they'd go to those banks, and those banks would collapse, not because those banks were doing wrong, it's just that the banks didn't keep all the money people wanted. And runs on banks began to get to be a real problem. By the 1880s, you were having some severe mini economic downturns because of these serial runs on banks. And then you had some of these boys up there on Wall Street and these rich banking people who would start a rumor that a bank was in trouble. The bank was fine, but when people heard that the bank was not in trouble, they'd all run to the bank, and the bank wouldn't have all the money that they could they deposited, and the bank would just collapse, and then the big boys would come in and gobble that bank up for pennies on the dollar. All kinds of nonsense was going on. Well, finally, in the second decade of the 20th century, Congress stepped in. We were in there was a little period in the 19-teens when the government was more active, I should say more liberal. And then we went into the 20s and it turned back the other way and things really went to hell then. But anyway, the deal was that there was recognition. We got to have a central bank. We got to have a central bank. So there was the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was passed. or was it 1917? One way or the other, it's in the in that broadcast, in that video. Okay, now the Federal Reserve was established with 12 in 12 districts. So essentially, the country's banks were geographically carved up into 12 districts. The problem was back then there weren't all that many people on the west side, so the districts on the west side of the country were huge. Like the one around San Francisco, wow, that's a big thing. And the ones on the east coast, where all the population was, where all the banks were, well, they were tiny, small, tight, compact districts. And things have changed over the years, but the districts are still the way they are. So the country was divided into 12 districts, and each of those districts would have a district bank of the Federal Reserve. Interestingly enough, right here where we are almost right on the boundary between two districts. To the north of us is the Chicago Federal Reserve District Bank. To the south of us is the St. Louis District Bank. Now, we're in the Chicago district here, but you go, I think, like 30, 40 miles south of here, and you're in the St. Louis district. And these district banks have their job to do. I'm going to show you something here. You probably already know this. I'm not going to be too tedious with you. But what's that big letter right there?
L.
What does it say around it? Can you see?
Federal Reserve Bank of...
I know, right?
California?
Well, no, not California.
It's California down the bottom.
Well, what's the name of the city? Can you read it? I can't. I mean,
San Francisco.
Oh, it's San Francisco. Yeah. L. Okay, this would have been printed at the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank. That's a district.
Now I've got another one in here. I think. Whoa, I got enough for Chick-fil-A tonight. Sweet.
Get something bigger than
I'm a professor, for Christ's sake. I don't get that. I can't. I don't have enough money to buy friends. If I want my cats to like me, I tie a pork chop around my neck. Okay, what does that one say? That's a B. What's the B?
Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Okay, New York's the biggie. It's the Empire Bank. It's the one where one of the most important things the Fed does happens there, which I'll talk about in just a little bit here. But anyway, the district banks... Here's how it works. The government, the legislature, the Congress, passes banking laws. Then what the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, those guys in Washington, those men and women in Washington, the seven governors, they regulate the banking system. In other words, they interpret those laws into actionable enforcement. And then the district banks, each district bank has a district bank president. Those district banks supervise the banks in their areas. So write this down. The governors regulate and the district bank presidents supervise the banks in their district, each in its district. Regulate and supervise. So in other words, one of the big, big jobs of the Fed is to regulate and supervise the banking system of the United States. And it's the governors who regulate, and the districts, district banks, the Board of Governors regulates, and the district banks supervise. Now, a second job of the Fed, and this is an interesting story. It might not sound interesting at first, but it actually has a political side to it that you might want to keep remember. The Federal Reserve Bank was chartered, well, very early on. It was understood that this bank should not be a bank that would destroy commercial banks. That's not its job. However, it would be good if this bank could be a bank for banks. In other words, you deposit money, your paycheck, banks have to have a place to put theirs. to do deposits and withdrawals. And so the Federal Reserve serves as a bank for banks. But it does that in direct competition with private commercial banks that are banks for banks. So in other words, but here's how the Fed's charter works. The Fed cannot use the power of the government to destroy these commercial its commercial competitors. And the Federal Reserve must be at the forefront of banking technology. Whenever it comes up with a new way to do banking, it has to share it freely with all of its competitors in the private sector. So in other words, if you run a bank, you could have your checking account with the Federal Reserve as your bank, or you could have a checking account with his private commercial bank. Either way, you have very sound banking, and he has the same state-of-the-art stuff that I have. Hence how those, in the old days, those checks with those magnetic numbers there at the bottom, that was all Fed, and it said, all right, all banks, use this now. In the age of the ATMs and the electronic transfers, the Fed was the one that created all of that, and then it made the technology available to every bank and credit union in the country free of charge. And so, essentially, it's like a public-private competition system. And it's interesting that it works. Someone had actually asked me, well, how many banks actually use the Fed versus how many banks use the use a private commercial bank? I didn't know at the time, so I called up a fellow I know at the Federal Reserve in St. Louis, and I said, all right, what are the numbers? And he said, I don't have the numbers right in front of me for the whole country, but in the St. Louis district, he said, I think at the time, 65% of banks used the Federal Reserve as their bank, and 35% used private commercial banks as their bank. Now, interestingly enough, the profits in this business are huge. All these banks, the commercial banks are making big money being banks for banks, and the Fed, what we call the Fed, is also making huge money. And every year, the Fed just hands over all this money that it makes from this being a bank for bank right to the Treasury. It's a vast amount of money. And the competition keeps the bank fees low for banks that need banking services. And interestingly enough, there were back in the 2009, there was all this debate about a national healthcare system. Are we going to try to create some kind of private market for it, which was how the Affordable Care Act turned out, Obamacare, or are we going to go with just nationalized single payer? I posted an article, why don't we do it like the Fed does with the banking thing? That works, it's demonstrable, it's been working for many decades. And the prices are very low because there's fierce competition between the Fed and the commercial banks to keep the prices low. Everyone's making money in this business. So why don't we just have the government have its health care insurance and let the private sector have its and make it like the Fed, where whatever the government system figures out to do, it has to share it freely with the others. No one wanted to hear that. The only model that would actually had a proven track record, it never even was considered in the whole debate over fixing the healthcare system. So there you go. Spill my coffee, getting pissed off about that. But anyway, okay. So now we have two duties of the Federal Reserve. It is regulates and supervises the banking system, and it serves as a bank for banks. Now, I need to go back here real quick with one last thing about regulates and supervises. Here's the problem. I remember the last book that was used, well, it's still being used by one professor here, and I don't use it anymore, but it laid out how that's not true. But it laid it out in such detail that it was almost laughable. I never tested anyone on it. You see, our regulatory system for banks is insane. The Federal Reserve does not regulate and supervise all banks. It regulates and supervises only a certain type of national bank. Other national banks are regulated and supervised by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Other national banks are regulated and supervised by some other department. If I count it right, there are actually 5 different regulators of banks, each one having its own group. And then there are state banks, state chartered banks. They're regulated and supervised by the state in which they are chartered. And then there are credit unions, which are regulated and supervised by their, or by some other regulatory body. That was one of the things that was just ridiculous. After the banking crisis in 2008 and 2009, they held these hearings. We got to get a system where all banks are regulated and supervised by one agency. Well, that wasn't going to happen. The turf war every one of these different regulatory agencies just got its political minions in order. It never got fixed. So we still have the same crazy quilt of regulation and supervision that we had up that led to the crisis in 2008, 2009. It didn't get fixed. So when I say the Federal Reserve regulates and supervises banks, no, it regulates and supervises a certain kind of national bank, what we call a member bank of the Federal Reserve System. Other banks have their own system, have their own regulators. And that's, of course, obviously that's going to cause some kind of a problem because you've got a crazy quilt of regulation. Some banks are regulated very strictly. Some banks are regulated less strictly. State chartered banks are regulated. Some states regulate their banks so rigorously that they actually hurt banking in their state. Other states regulate their banks not very well, and that actually causes risks to the banking system there. So there you go. Okay. Federal Reserve regulates and supervises some banks. The Federal Reserve serves as a bank for banks. Those are 2 of its 3 duties. The third of its 3 duties is that it conducts monetary policy. It controls the money supply. Now, the Fed was chartered. Now, remember what I told you. There is one and only one cause of inflation. No, inflation cannot happen just because a couple of companies jack up their prices. No, inflation is not does not happen because gas prices go up. No, inflation doesn't happen because we raise the minimum wage or because some union got a sweeter contract deal. One of my students, a libertarian, just was pissing his pants yesterday. Oh, you can't tell me that raising wages will not cause inflation. Yes, I can tell you that. Well, I've heard differently. That's because you're listening to dumbasses. Only one thing. Look, I've got a specific pile of money. I buy apple pies from you. I buy flower arrangements from you. If you raise your prices, that just simply means that I can't buy as much from you. So demand for your stuff goes down. So your prices go down because yours went up. No inflation. It smooths itself out. The only thing that can create inflation is too much money chasing the economy. The money supply needs to grow at the growth rate of the economy, the real growth rate of the economy. That's what the money supply should grow. If it grows too fast, we get inflation. If it grows too slowly, we get deflation. So one of the primary duty in conducting monetary policy of the Fed originally was to maintain stability of the aggregate price level. In other words, no inflation, no deflation. You are to create money only at the real growth rate of the economy. Don't print too much, don't print too little. In other words, the government depoliticized money. Because the temptation is always there to print more money, because if you print more money for a while, you feel great. I give you more money. It's only later that you don't feel so great because it's created inflation. So you're back to square one. So then I have to print more money, and then you feel good for a while, but then prices go up again, and you're back to square one. This is a death spiral, and we've done it. Almost every nation on earth has gone through a death spiral like this, where they start printing more money just to make things jizz up a little bit, and then, oh, well, here we go, inflation. Well, we'll just print more money. Oops, inflation. Print more money, quick. That's the death spiral we got into in the 70s. We kept trying to run ahead, and eventually we got to the point where the inflation was so strong that as soon as we printed it, prices went up. Prices were going up before we printed the money. Expectations. Okay. So the original charter was maintain stability of the aggregate price level. Unfortunately, it was in the 1970s. Sure enough, the Congress passed a second rule. The Fed should help the economy. Repoliticizing money. Essentially, the Fed had now two contradictory rules. One, not to print money just because the economy was suffering. And two, to print wads of it when the economy was suffering. The Fed was put between a rock and a hard place because you can't do both. Essentially, printing money was supposed to be just sort of like a mechanical thing. The growth rate was this, we grow the money supply this. The growth rate was this, we grow the money supply this much. But then when the Congress said, Federal Reserve, you will print money to make people feel better. When the economy is down, print some money. Ah, don't worry, you can bring that money back home when the economy boosts up. It never happens. And that was the problem, and it's the problem to this day. We gin up the economy with more money during the bad times, but then there is it's political disaster. Ask the last president who did it. His name was James Earl Carter. After years of printing money until we had a hyperinflation going on, virtually a hyperinflation, he put in a Federal Reserve chairman, Paul Volcker, who said enough. And he just clawed the money back and the economy. Money, please. No. Not until you believe that we're not going to do this anymore. And it took a couple of years for the markets to actually believe. The expectation was so embedded. So there you go. That's where we are now. Anyway, enough of that. We're going to talk a little more about that at the end of this lecture. But anyway, the third duty of the Federal Reserve is to conduct monetary policy. Now, the Fed has three tools for monetary policy, to conduct monetary policy. Now, one of these tools is blunt. It's just you wouldn't probably use it for monetary policy. You would use it more to handle the banking system when there were difficulties, people were not confident. It's called the required reserve ratio, or the fractional reserve ratio, as some call it. The required reserve ratio. It works like this. Remember I said the banks don't keep all of the money that's deposited. They keep some of it. And then they invest the rest. That's one of the ways they make money, so that they can pay you interest on your deposits and all that kind of stuff. So historically, it was before there were central banks, banks had to decide on how much they kept on their own. The Fed now says, you will keep this much in your vaults. So the way it works is like this. Imagine, if you will, You're walking along the street and a $100 bill falls down. Well, let's say it's a $1,000 bill. They don't print thousand anymore. Okay. Well, you come to me. I'm the banker. And you deposit the money. Well, let's say that I keep 10% as my fractional reserve. And then the rest I can lend out and make interest on. Okay. So, in other words, what will happen is we have $1,000 to start this game. Printed, comes out of nowhere. So I'm going to keep 100 of it. Now there's $900 that I have that I can lend. Now you come to me, you are a business person in town, and you walk up to me, come into the bank and say, I should like to borrow some money for a business. Okay. I can lend you $900. You say, good. So you borrow $900 because I've got $900. You pay it to this guy to build the building. It's an escort service. And so you got $900. You did the building. And you come to my bank and you put that $900 in there. Okay, I've got now on my balance sheet $1,900. Well, I'm going to put 10% of that $90 in the vault in case you come back for some money or you write a check and I have to pay someone for the check. And so I have $810 to lend out. You, sir, come to me. I'm a business person. I need some money to start a business. Well, what kind of a business are you going to start? Well, I was thinking of doing some kind of, fruit baskets and deliver them to the elderly. Well, that's a nice thing. $810 is what I can lend you. So I lend it to you, and you pay him to get the business going. He's your first employee, and $810. He comes to my bank, and he puts that $810 in the bank. Well, now I have to keep $81 of it. But then I have $729, is that right, to lend out. Well, someone else comes in and I lend them that $729. Look at what's happening to the money supply. It's expanding on its own. At the end of the day, if you go through, there's a mathematical thing called a series that you can add up these numbers at the end of the day. The total amount of money, the change in the money supply, will be the original amount times 1 over the required reserve ratio. So in this case, at the end of the day, the total change in the money supply would be the original $1,000 times 1 over 0.10. So in other words, an initial kick of $1,000 created $10,000 of money in the system. Wow. So in other words, what we're saying here is that if the Fed increases the required reserve ratio, that would slow down the growth of the money supply. If the Fed decreases the money supply, decreases the required reserve ratio, that would accelerate the growth rate of the money supply. Do you see that? The required reserve ratio is in the denominator, so that multiplier gets bigger as required reserve ratio gets smaller. Someone asked me, and this has been like 5 years ago, and I was a little bothered that I didn't know the answer. Some student in one of these classes said, well, what is the required reserve ratio? What is it actually in real life? I didn't know. I was assuming, it's probably around 10%. Well, so I called the Fed in St. Louis. They're very helpful. They've got a lot of people who want to help. It's considered the education Fed and all that. So he said, well, believe it or not, it's not as simple as you teach it. I said, wait, why? He said, yeah, there are actually 3 required reserve ratios. He said, there is a required reserve ratio for the first $10 million in deposits. Then there's a required reserve ratio for 10 million, I think it's to 100 million. And then there's a required reserve ratio for above $100 million in deposits. And I said, well, I didn't know that. I said, well, what's the $0 to $10 million tranche? And T-R-A-N-C-H-E, that's called a tranche. What's the $0 to $10 million tranche required reserve ratio? And he said, believe it or not, it's zero. Wait, why? Let's see. 1/0 is error. That's infinity. He said, yeah. He said, we want, that's because those kinds of banks are tiny banks. So it doesn't hurt to have them accelerating the money supply. Just essentially, they don't, what he was saying was these smaller banks don't have to keep any money in the vault, basically. They can, there's no required reserve ratio on them. And that just, to this day, I'm not sure I buy that. But the required reserve ratio for the next tranche, I think he said it was at the time like 6.something%, and then the next one was at 8%, something like that. But again, this is a blunt as hell tool. I mean, it's just a big a meat cleaver. Now, more likely, the Fed would change its required reserve ratio based upon worries that people were going to run banks. So, for example, after 9/11, there was a serious concern that people were going to freak out and run to their banks to get all their money out. So the Fed upped the required reserve ratio just to make sure banks would still have enough money in the vault to satisfy essentially irrational demand for money. As it turned out, people didn't freak. You know, it was more or less, well, yeah, that was bad, but I'm not going to run to my bank and get my money out. So the Fed eased back down. So in other words, this is a tool of monetary policy, but it's more likely that you would see the Fed change this for other reasons. Okay, the second one that I would bring up, the second tool of monetary policy, is the discount rate. The Fed will lend money to banks that need money. The Fed will lend money. However, a lot of banks will, the discount rate is very low. And in recent years, since the financial crisis, it's been essentially, effectively, almost about zero. But a lot of banks historically did not go to the Fed, to the discount window to borrow money. They would go to other banks in a market called the federal funds market. It's essentially the giant, vast pool of all the money the banks have. And banks can go to this federal funds market, and they'll pay a higher rate called the federal funds rate. The Fed does not set the federal funds rate. It tries to affect it, and it has a powerful third tool to do that. But it can't set the federal funds rate. It amazes me, almost every time the Federal Open Market Committee, as it's called, meets, you'll see these financial experts say, well, the Fed set the federal funds rate at, no, it doesn't. It can target it, and then it can use this third tool to try to move it to where its target is, but it can't set the federal funds rate. It sets the discount rate because that's what the Fed lends money at. Now, interestingly enough, as I said, historically, banks didn't go to the discount window. Even though the rate was lower there than the federal funds rate, banks went to each other to borrow money. Why would you do that? Why would you go to other banks in this overnight market called the federal funds market if the Fed's standing right there, hey, we lend money, here are our discount window at a lower rate? Any logic to that? Is that irrational, or was there some reason for that? Can you think of any reason? Well, let me ask you this. Okay. You got yourself in a spot of trouble, and you need $1,000. I'm your dad. This is your rich friend. Now, you come to me for $1,000, what am I going to do? Remember, I am an asshole.
Probably say no.
No, I'll give it to you. I mean, I don't want you to. But I'm going to ask a lot of questions. You have failed me for the last time. What is this money for? Who the hell were you with? He isn't going to do that. You see? So, do you see the logic of why you go to the interbank lending market instead of to dad? Sometimes you'll go to dad. You know, your dad might be a sucker, an idiot, and all that. But not likely. I might keep an eye on you about that. I might bitch at you. Might go, come over to your place to see what the hell is going on, you see. Sure. You're good for the money. That's why you would see... historically, banks would go to other banks. Now, after the financial near apocalypse in 2008, the Fed was being so generous, the banks just lined up for money. Just ridiculous how embarrassing it was. And I got a story to tell you about that in about a week or two. But for now, it's just one of the most disturbing stories you might ever hear in finance. But anyway, the discount rate. Fed can set the discount rate, the rate at which it lends money. Now, for a long time, that discount rate was virtually zero. Just recently, the Fed has begun to worry about inflation. And so it has bumped up the discount rate and has signaled that it's going to claw back some of that money that it's been shoveling into the economy for the last 7 years. We'll see. Interestingly enough, what the Fed was seeing was something that I've been calling for quite a while. The Federal Reserve prints money, but it doesn't just hand it to everyone like it might have done in the 30s. It cycles it through the banking system. So that what was happening was for all this time, since the Fed started shoveling money into the economy to pull it out of this mess, the banks were getting that money and they were using it to drive things like investments. Hence why the stock market was skyrocketing like gangbusters for these past years. Because that money wasn't getting to us. If you look at our level, can you tell me what's been happening to gas prices over the last couple of years?
Going up and down.
Well, not up and down as much as... Are you old enough to remember what gas prices were in the early 2000s? $4.39 stupid cents. Things like that. We've been seeing at the lower level, at our level, a collapse of prices, a deflation. So you were seeing a sector inflation of securities prices, which was where all that money the Fed had been printing was going, and it was creating a sector inflation. But at the commodities level, at our level, prices have been stable or declining. So when the Fed finally last week said, end of the gravy train, we're going to clamp down on the money supply, it's not going to affect us much at all. We haven't been seeing that money being shoveled to us, but it was sure what happened to the stock market last week and early this week. Down like that, because suddenly the gravy train had ended on that sector. It's pretty simple. The third tool of monetary policy is what is called the open market operations, the OMOs. Essentially, what the Fed does is that when it wants to expand the money supply, well, let's say that, okay, first of all, there is this committee called the Federal Open Market Committee. It is the seven governors and five district bank presidents. The district bank presidents serve rotating two-year terms except for one. The president of the Empire Bank, the New York Bank, New York Fed, is always there. So four of the seats trade over, but one district bank president is always there because the Empire Bank is where the open market operations are executed. So he always has a say. Okay, here's how it works. Essentially, the Federal Open Market Committee, let's say it decides that it is going to increase the money supply. The New York Bank president goes back to the New York Bank. You're the domestic desk manager. It's called the domestic trading desk. And I say to you, your traders must now expand the money supply. Okay? So what you do, you have two drawers. One has money in it. The other has treasury bills in it. You call me a bank president. Now, in my tier one capital, I have money in treasury bills. So what you do is you and the other traders start calling your banks and saying, I want to buy some of your T-bills. Okay? So as the demand for T-bills goes up, their prices go up, which causes their yields to go down. First thing, interest rates are falling. The second thing is, as I sell those T-bills to you, you send me money. More money in the federal system, federal funds rate falls. That's an open market operation to expand the money supply. The other side of it would be if you're contracting the money supply. Now, I think I had promised you some conspiracy theory. Okay? Well, you see, first thing that you have to appreciate is that at the end of the 1990s, we had paid off all of our bills as government. We were running budget surpluses. We were running them several years in a row, and there was nothing but sunshine ahead. Well, you see, if the government isn't borrowing money, it's not issuing treasury bills. So you traders don't have any more treasury bills, so you can't execute open market operations. The Fed's most powerful tool, day in, day out, is gone. The Fed no longer controls the economy. So that's why when we started the 2000s, we claimed there was a recession. There wasn't. Cut taxes, the longest, deepest cuts in history. We entered two theater wars, and we started running bloody, massive federal budget deficits again. Treasury started issuing treasury bills. You were back in business. But now comes the upshot. Here's where it came to a head. I printed this chart just before the crash. Do you see? The Fed had crushed the money supply. Essentially, M1, which is the money that businesses and people use, wasn't growing, even though the economy was. The Fed stopped publishing M3, which contains the euro dollars. We were buying so much from China that vast hundreds of billions of dollars was in these illiquid Chinese foreign reserves that were being lent to the United States for its budget deficits. Oh, people always ask me, what is this spike? Oh, that was when I told you about when 9/11 happened, the Fed poured money into the banks to make sure they had enough. But anyway, this was right before the disaster on September 15th. Do you see how it was begging to happen? The Fed was deliquidifying the base economy, trying its best to do something about that bleeding. The Fed stopped publishing M3. They said, oh, no one used it. No, they stopped publishing it because it was such a disaster. And how were they trying to solve that disaster? By making it so that normal businesses and people didn't have any money. That's what drove the massive buckling of the economy on September 15th. The largest investors in money markets said, the hell with this, we're going to pull our money out. There was no liquidity to replace it, and so everything died. But that's not the end of the story. I do want to bring one real quick thing. I promise it'll be the end of this lecture. Remember I said, that thing right there, that was just 9/11, you know, when the Fed conducted this huge operation, put money into all these trucks, just drove it to banks all over the country so they'd have money. So in case everyone ran the banks. But there's one problem with that story. See that spike right there? That's September 11. Oh, wait. Why was the Fed pouring billions and billions of dollars into the banks in the week leading up to the attack? How could it possibly have known that the banks would have to have all that money in case people ran the banks? This is early September. The Fed is already driving the trucks to the banks, putting money into them in case there's runs on the banks. The operation was pretty much completed by 9/11. One last punch. There's nothing to see here, folks. Nothing at all. That's all I have for you. Go home.